you try to do something to make the onboarding a little easier, and you just keep figuring things out. And I don't know, there's something about, even before it takes off, just like knowing, like, I had a customer, they used it last week, they hit this problem, that same customer does it this week, they're not going to hit it anymore, right? Like, it's just so gratifying. And we're just helping people build things faster.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Hey, everyone. Today, we're talking with Colin Sidoti, who's the co-founder and CEO of Clark, which is the user management platform built for the modern web. He actually founded Clark in 2019 with his brother, Braden, having been frustrated for years with the auth options as he tinkered on side projects. And Clark has been on an absolute tear over the past 2 years. Their team's fully remote. They have a very particular way of working. And so in today's conversation, we're going to dig into Colin's background, how they built the team, and their particular approach to getting the work done. So Colin, we're psyched to have you on.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks so much for having me.
I am curious, what inspired you to start a company with your brother?
My background is very entrepreneurship heavy. I've always been kind of starting companies since college. I was always the technical co-founder. They all kind of failed. And instead of trying to like latch on to someone who knows the business side better, for this one, I was like, I'm just going to do something for developers. And came up with Clark and kind of shared the problems with Braden, who was also an engineer. And I think it surprised me, but it really resonated with him. He was kind of at a point of transitioning jobs as well, and it kind of just worked out. Off to the races.
How have the past couple of years been going, for folks who don't know?
The last couple of years have been great. The lead up to the last couple of years were a little trying. I think it's like the classic trope. Like, if you know how easy, if you knew how hard it would be, you would never have started. But it's really been a lot of fun the whole way. And every step of the way, I think we knew we were getting better. We were definitely surprised at kind of how long it took to inflect and kind of gravitate towards people, start getting pulled by the market.
Yeah. Those things are incredibly unpredictable in my experience.
It's really bizarre. Our whole mindset was like, we're going to iterate. We're going to try to do something every week. Put something in front of people. And like every time you'd see something and it'd be like, that's a problem. We can improve that. Let's go improve it. And I think every one, we kind of convince ourselves like, this is going to be the one. And it was just amazing how it wasn't for so long. But I think that, you know, feeling like every week we're actually making things better goes a really long way to that period being trying, but like still looking back on it as being fun.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you talk about before that looking back, there's not one thing that you could point to that caused the inflection upward, but instead the amalgamation of all of these things that at a certain point crossed the threshold that allowed the company to take off. And so I can understand the optimism at each individual change, feeling like this is going to be the one that does the trick. How big is the team today and how does that rough out across functions?
We are about 80 people now. And I guess I should give my little overlay on Clark as well. I think outside looking in, a lot of people don't realize is that we're more than just off. And so, you know, if we were just off and we were 80 people, that's surprising. But our mindset at Clark is, how do we solve the whole user management problem? And the way we think about that is, you know, given Braden and I's engineering background, we both had experienced this problem of like, yes, sign in is hard and it was too hard. But then after that, you weren't done. Like, you had to sync your user data with Stripe and with Salesforce and HubSpot and your analytics tools and so on. And you could kind of go into any big software company and everyone had written that chunk of code themselves. And if you actually talk to the people that had done it, they all kind of hated working on it. And so we really tried to architect Clark in a way where we would be able to help with that full set of problems, not just auth in the long run. And tying back to the question of, how is this team broken up? I think probably over half of it is just building and scaling off. We have over 10,000 products that we're supporting, hundreds of millions of users. And so just scaling that system is like not trivial. As AI is going crazy, like the bots are getting better. And we have like a lot of AI customers that do freemium plans and they have a lot of free trial abuse and so on. And so we've had to invest a ton in blocking that. Beyond scaling, there's also a big billing team that's building out an integration with Stripe. And there's a pretty big orgs team. And the way we define orgs is if you're building a B2B SaaS, you know, you don't just have user accounts, you also have an organization account where someone sets up their organization, they invite their team, they set people's roles and permissions. So we have a set of flows to help developers with that as well. And so those two teams are a pretty big chunks of it. We're very engineering heavy. That's kind of the product split and a functional split or PLG, not really sales led. We do have a lot of support, right? So our Discord is staffed, our little chat bubble on the website is staffed. And so we do like to help as much as we can people get started with their.
You mentioned that the team's fairly engineering heavy, your product-led growth, you know, PLG, so that makes sense. Do you have a sense for engineering headcount, product and design, if we're thinking about more like the technical folks?
I don't think of the engineering versus design as like a different function. To me, it's like all the builders part. And so even when I said engineers and we're engineering heavy, like I was including the designers in that.
And roughly what percentage of the company are builders for that matter?
It's definitely over half. I would say it's 3/4 off the top of my head.
And your role is CEO. I think your brother, Braden, he's the CTO. Where do you spend most of your time as CEO?
Practically, the way the split has ended up happening, it's still very builder-centric. I think Braden is managing like a lot of the scaling and back-end side of things. And then I'm more on the front-end DX side of things. But that's really still where our attention is. We actually were just together and, you know, talking about a pricing update. And I think there's things like that where we do have to come together, but we do it like once a quarter, once every 4 months even. And so for the most part, we're just kind of running in those lanes and the rest doesn't really actually change all that much. The thing driving pricing is we're introducing billing, and just like as the product expands, some of the old pricing doesn't strictly make sense anymore. Yeah, I think people are surprised at this, right? There's no sales founder. There's just like, yeah, it's pretty much still Braden's back end, Colin's front end.
There are a lot of folks in the engineering community who despise the idea of sales and marketing and really like the idea though that they could be successful without it. And so, you know, whether or not that's a realistic statement is a totally different conversation.
Yeah, it's just funny. I should extend a little bit. While I would say that like priority is front and back end, I think our secondary responsibilities are actually Colin is marketing and Braden is sales. For whatever reason, I think Braden is better at sales and I'm better at marketing. And so if there is a bigger customer, we're throwing Braden on the call and I'm the one on Twitter a lot more.
I want to talk a little bit about how the company is actually organized in terms of the way that the work takes place. The company was founded in 2019. Today, the company is fully remote and I understand globally distributed. Was that always the intent from day one?
I would definitely say it was not the intent. And this is part of sort of how I came to love startups. For whatever reason, ended up in Dropbox's office back in like 2012. And that was, to me, it was like peak San Francisco, like there's scooters all in the office. They had this like famous chef. I definitely like expected, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start a startup. We're going to start one of these offices. It's going to be a great time. It didn't pan out that way. I think all of 2019, Braden and I were working out of South Park Commons, who was our earliest investor. But then 2020 came, which is when we did the next round. And we basically closed that funding. Like our early meetings with that investor were in person, and then the last meetings were on Zoom. You know, it got to this thing right away of, are we going to hire in San Francisco? Are we going to hire remote? And we talked to both sets of people. You know, when we talked to San Francisco people, it was like, hey, what do you think of this remote thing? Seems like we might be doing it for a little bit. And they're like, yeah, like we'll figure it out. And then we actually talked to someone in Greece that our new investor had worked with before. And, you know, so what do you think of this remote thing? I've been doing it for a decade. Like, I know exactly what to do, right? And so we did that. It made more sense at the time. And it's one of those things you can't really half commit to. We've been doing it ever since. Despite being remote, we are still rather heavily synchronous. And so we have not hired around the clock, really. That's been deliberate, where it's just US and EU. And those morning hours are pretty sacred. Morning hours to me, afternoon hours to the EU, because that's kind of like our sync time. And we've just preserved that time, and we've always kind of needed it. We've never been able to pull off the like fully async workflow kind of check in, check out thing. It just hasn't worked for us. We value those couple hours a day. Maybe that's our slight compromise on remote.
You mentioned that at this moment, when you were sort of assessing hiring, hey, should we do it locally here in San Francisco, with folks' reaction being like, yeah, we'll figure out the remote thing, versus this connection that you had with somebody in Greece who said, yeah, I mean, we've been doing this for 10 plus years. Like, I know exactly how to do it. Were there any lessons or tactics or things that that person imparted on you of how to do remote well, having had them have so much experience before coming in?
You need people, like, especially for Braden and I, like, we needed someone to like, show us the way. And I think that a couple hours of overlap early on, we didn't set it out explicitly, but that was really the biggest thing. Like, we made sure to talk to each other in that period. And you have like handoffs, right? I think there's probably a point when we crossed like 50 or 60 where things change. So before, it was very much like we tried to be effectively like 14-hour day, where Greece would do things in the morning, they'd hand things off, we'd pick it up in the US. And at that point in time, like, that 2 hours of handoff was super critical. And just collaboration, where'd you get, what can I take on? As the team has grown, we've started to do more like, there's an EU team, there's a US team. The leaders of the teams kind of need to talk to each other in that window. But like, there's people in California that sign on at 9 o'clock every morning. That's totally fine. I mean, it's just communicate, right? Like, you got that 2 hour, a couple hour window, like, leverage it. We always found it was easier to do knowledge transfer and context transfer synchronously, to jump on a quick call. And I feel like James Hawkins from Posthog is going to roast me for saying jump on a quick call as being easy. It is. This is where I should talk about Tuple. And I know it's not an advertisement, but those quick calls, they're not normally scheduled, right? We're all online in those 2 hours, but the way we actually communicate is through Tuple. And it's like, if you have something to share, you just go and you Tuple someone. And there is something that happened when we switched from like regularly scheduled transfer contacts to, you know, just Tuple me. It just like streamlined. Everything feels less stressful. The meeting doesn't happen if it doesn't need to happen. It goes long if it needs to go long. I just try to save that sliver of time, and so people can call me.
What I'm hearing you say is that there's a really strong emphasis on serendipitous, ad hoc, synchronous communication, as opposed to really structured handoffs, be them synchronous or asynchronous. This like fluidity seems to be something that is shining through in the way that you're talking about it. Do you have any philosophies or processes around that? Or is it really just like, hey, if you need somebody, call them. And it's kind of that simple.
There is no organizational wide mandate of like rigid way to do it. What happens is that the different teams have all kind of formed their own thing. And so if you ever switch teams, like, here, there's a reasonable chance you're changing your communication paradigm. It's not like, oh, I'm now subscribing to this team's communication paradigm. That team like adapts. Like, we're all kind of humans. The teams aren't that big. If someone doesn't like waking up before 9, like, you figure it out. There's definitely a ton of fluidity. Yet I think if you really look at the 5 or 6 person teams, you would say, oh, this team has its own way of working. And that looks pretty rigid at any point in time.
one of the ways of working that I've heard you talk about before is the concept of the DX guide, which relates more specifically in the way that product work is done, yeah. I think. I wanted to talk a little bit about it because I think it's an interesting thing. Can you give a brief summary of what is the DX guide and how does it inform the way that product work gets done?
It's kind of like the one exception to everything I'm saying, right? Everything's fluid. There's no process except for the DX guide. DX guide, it's ultimately, it's just like, how is a customer going to use this thing that you're building? It ends up looking a lot like the docs that eventually get published. It's really just like Clerk is a DX company almost first and foremost, right? Our goal is to take user management, this broad problem, not just auth, but all these other features, billing, CRM, so on. Like, how do we make it easier? It's too easy to lower the bar, to fall back to, well, this is how such and such did it. That's going to be how I do it. And so we have this sanity check of the DX guide that's an opportunity for really everyone at the company to go and say, this could be better. It is there as a forcing function to make sure that things are staying up to the quality bar and they're not breaking some of our product like core philosophies. There are certain things that, you know, to be able to do a very clean billing product or a very clean think, like you can't start introducing lots of levers and tools, and it's really levers. Like if things get too flexible on how we manage a user, then the ways we can automate kind of distributing the user data to Stripe and to HubSpot, it gets harder. If you give people freeform fields instead of first name, last name, birthday, then it gets harder. So there's certain things like that that have just evolved over years of seeing what works and what doesn't work that, I don't know, we're just very cautious of. Clerk is still very much off today. The org's product is actually flying. It's doing really well. I think for whatever reason, people don't look at that as like an evolution of an auth business. To me, like we're the only ones selling an org's product. And I think the market is starting to pick up on that. Like, oh, wow, I definitely would have had to build these myself if Clerk didn't hand them to me. But it's like close enough to auth that it doesn't feel like it changes the business substantially. Whereas once billing's done, people are like, what the hell is an auth company doing with billing? That doesn't make sense in anything from the old world, yet it's a very natural product extension for us. And I think when billing is out, the lessons we're going to learn along the way from, first of all, getting it released to getting it like really flying, like markets pulling that product, I think they're going to be substantial. And then maybe on the CRM product or support suite product, like there's so many different things we can build. Maybe those next ones will be able to pull back the hard stop in the product development cycle of like, you need to get this DX guide approval. But as of right now, like we've kept that in there until we feel like the perception of Clerk is actually the vision of Clerk. Right now, I think the perception of Clerk is still just auth company.
Okay. So you're using this DX guide to make sure that you're adhering to the philosophies and standards that you insist on for delivering an incredible developer experience. And it takes into consideration a bunch of the stuff that you mentioned. And it sounds like in your product development process, that's the thing that happens first. And then that's passed to the separate group of builders who actually then execute against it or figure out the implementation details. Do I have that right?
The implementation details, I think, like, you're hired as an engineer at Clerk, like, we trust you to get it right. There's review processes, there's so on. But the parts that the developer interacts with do come first. I will challenge a little bit of what you said. As much as figuring out the DX guide is first, it very frequently requires mocking it up in code. And so people do that as part of the exercise to find it, because sometimes you just can't tell, is this thing that I wrote on paper going to work right? And sometimes the DX guide review conclusion is, you know, it looks right. It feels like there might be something here that like smells a little funny. Why don't you go mock it out without doing a full implementation, but like get a demo working off of Mox, and then we'll revisit this and decide, should we kind of stamp it forward and go code, or do we need to go back to the drawing board more?
What do you like most about this process?
I don't think people understand how much I actually love watching someone use Clerk and like just seeing the reaction. I was just on something yesterday with Lovable where we did a live setup of Clerk and just, you know, why would I use Clerk instead of X? And they're just flying in the chat, right? And then we go and we show, it's always the same thing. You set up sign in, the questions are still coming in, like what's going on? And then you get to the user button, which is the little kind of avatar button in the top right of like most of the websites. You click it and there's like a manage account button there. You click manage account and like first of all, they see it and they're like, they see the user button. And that's the first like, huh, there is something different here. And then they click manage account and they see the full, oh, I can already upload an avatar. Like nothing comes with that. And then they see like 2FA being available there. And then you layer on the org things. And it's just like you progressively watch like draws drop further. It's very fun for me, especially because I know kind of exactly what points they're going to be excited about. Having done it with user and just fighting through that product from zero to like flying. Now we've pulled it off with the orgs now. I feel very comfortable saying that, but it took like another full year. And I wouldn't be surprised if billing ends up the same way, where you get it out there and there's just like things on the edges that are still going a little wrong. And you do customer interviews, say, go try this out. You look for where things are going wrong. You try to do something to make the onboarding a little easier and you just keep figuring things out. And I don't know. There's something about when it actually, even before it takes off, just like knowing, like I had a customer that used it last week, they hit this problem. That same customer does it this week. They're not going to hit it anymore. Right. Like it's just so gratifying. And we're just helping people build things faster. And like Clerk has 10,000 apps in prod now. And just looking at the diversity of apps, it's just like things I never could have thought of. Like it's so cool to be enabling that. That's what keeps me going. I think like, yeah, like I know that that DX guide process kind of is what keeps the magic in there. As the company expands, the number of people that were here and lived through getting users to fly versus getting orgs to fly, it's like it's an opportunity to bring in that expertise and share kind of learnings past. And like ultimately, despite it being a painful synchronous process and an otherwise pretty low process company, like I think it does help us move faster.
When I heard you talk about the DX guide before, it was my understanding that you don't have anybody with like a dedicated product manager title. You got a head of product. And so folks kind of rotate through to actually create the DX guide so that it's not like dedicated product managers who are doing that. Is there any process for like touching grass and staying in front of customers and getting an understanding of what's going on the front lines?
We took a VP of engineering and we made them run support. I think most people really would be surprised at how little process we've instituted. The VP of engineering that went to run support, like we know that Discord is receiving thousands of messages a day. We know that there's got to be gold in there that can help us improve the product. And we're having a really hard time synthesizing it. And it's too easy to argue that the support side, the dev success side is like below a VP of engineering. It's just not like you have to hire the people that like culturally get it, like get that this is the most important thing, because like ultimately what got us off the ground originally was the team was so small and every single one of us was handling support, was having the customer calls and watching the customer try to use it and watching them fail and jumping onto Google Meet when something went wrong and doing screen shares. Like that's how we figured it out. And as we grew and support kind of got carved off into its own thing, it was obvious that something had gone that we had lost something. I think the guy's title is still VP of engineering. we don't change these things. I don't know. It was just like, that was the most important thing for the company to do. And like someone stepped up and did it. And I'd say we're actually like really bad at hiring for a clear, well-defined role as much as like for someone that understands the mission and can help in their own way to push it forward. And so the guy that ended up raising his hand for support, there's someone else that raises their hand for like product management stuff, like the traditional product management side of things. So it's, like, I think we do all of these functions. It's just very unstructured getting there. The person who leads a product, like a new offering, is usually the person that cares about it the most. And so much of our challenge is just hiring people that are going to care a lot. The person who struggles the most at Cleric is the one that's like looking for, what are my tasks today? These are my tasks. I'm going to do my tasks to be done. I know it's a weird place to work in this sense, but it's just worked for us. Like, we've managed to find enough people that really just like take pride and joy out of helping the customer succeed.
I think it makes sense that because you as the CEO dread process, that the subsequent company does not have a lot of process. And instead you have these compensatory measures, which is hiring people who don't need process in order to be successful. Are there any other aspects about the way the work gets done at Cleric that we didn't cover yet, Colin, that you think are sort of worth noting or things that you're proud of?
We have a strong sense of who our customer is and who it isn't. I think the way this ends up manifesting is really just like a lot of the company has a pretty good sense of when to say no. The people who migrate from Auth0 to Cleric, right? This happens every week. The ones that come to us are the ones that are coming for our expertise on sign up, sign in, user profile, and even some of the org stuff now. Like, they want us to tell them the right way to handle sign in. Like, we don't just want to do sign in, we want to do the best version of sign in. Like, the way we tackle it is we go look at the biggest companies and we see how do they do sign in. And we do the same on orgs, right? We go to the biggest B2B SaaS in the world, right? We look at G Suite. It's phenomenal. We look at their flows and how they do creating an organization and inviting people to the team and so on. And then we'll go to like Adobe, right? These things that people don't even think of necessarily. I think a lot of people make the mistake of, what's the startup that's growing really fast? Let's copy them. And it's like, that's not actually what you want. You want the really established one that has done the thorny things, because chances are the startup isn't done yet. Like, chances are they have some big enterprise customer that they're going to have to kind of change their authentication authorization system for in the future. But if you go to a Dropbox and a G Suite and so on, you kind of can be confident that it's already done. And so we look at those as reference points and we say, this is confidently the right way to do things. And people can either come to us for our expertise on that, or they could just go use something else. Right? Like, Auth0 is this endlessly flexible thing that you can like literally hook in and like change the code as it runs. Like, they have these hooks in the thing. And that's great. It works for everyone. I guess my assertion is that like Cleric works for everyone too, but for these cases where they're migrating, they might have to do some extra work to like migrate to what is currently the best way to do things. And we don't change our thesis on what's best for the big sale. We instead are more excited about doing auth right, doing orgs right, and now doing billing right, because I think that helps us, first of all, expand the scope of all the things we can help people with faster. But it also just, it drives a higher caliber product, right? Like, it's just a totally different product thinking mindset. We're constantly thinking about what is the best way to do this, not what is the way to get this one big customer. And I think that that just, it's a really invigorating way to do things. And because Cleric's been growing as fast as it's been growing, like, we get to keep doing it, right? We get to keep doubling down. And it's like such a privilege to do that because it's just more fun work.
So what do you do to cultivate that culture?
I think it does really just come down to hiring again. This process of learning to find the people that like really take pride in serving the customer. And they don't look at a task as just do the task. They look at it as do the task, but also sanity check it to make sure it's good, right? To make sure it's actually driving the goal of making a developer's life easier. Finding those people is hard, but it's like very worth it. The best thing is that they know each other. And we have these little clusters of basically people recruiting their old favorite coworkers. That's been a big way to cultivate it, I guess, specifically. The first set, I think we really struggled with finding.
So what I heard you say is that it's an immense focus on making sure you're bringing the right folks in the door as defined by this obsession with actually caring about the details and doing the thing that is right and if independent of the amount of work involved. And while finding the first batch of people like that may be quite difficult, once you get some, it's a lot easier to get more.
It very well could be most at this point. You do your reference calls and so on. I think you also just have a willingness for it to not work. And we do this thing where we try to scare people away, right? Like, and that's maybe the wrong side of the coin to present it in, but I think that's the mindset. Like, we tell people in the interview process, like, this is what it's going to be like. If this doesn't sound like you, just say no. It's just better for us to not proceed in this interview process if this is scary to you, if this is not exciting to you, and so on. Someone has added that as like a deliberate scare people away step of the process, while most of the people in the process are taking the positive side of it. Like, it really is a lot more fun to work here as a result of that, I think, or at least it's the kind of place I would enjoy working at more. There's something you said in the framing of this question. Regardless of how much extra work it takes to make things easier, I think that's a huge part of it. If we can spend a month to get rid of one line of code that our developer has to write, we will do it. And there was this big thing that was more than a month recently where you can now try Clerk without a Clerk account. So if you go and you're setting up a Next.js app, you can just npmi the Clerk Next.js package and see the whole sign up, sign in user profile flow all before you go and sign up for an account. And that was because we just hated that the first step was go sign up for a Clerk account. We wanted to get rid of that step from the onboarding. And it was a multi-month project getting rid of that. But yeah, we've done something in the culture right to like breed that level of, first of all, caring about getting rid of the step, but also willingness to spend the time to get rid of the step.
Well, what's crazy about that example is that also gives you way less visibility as to who that person is, which you could, I think, reasonably or logically argue is a bad thing, because it's like, hey, from a business perspective, now we don't know who all these people are. But I suspect if you make those decisions consistently, you result in a product experience or a developer experience that's so radically different than what somebody has experienced before that it doesn't matter. What's your reaction to that, that trade-off?
It definitely came up. It was a bit scary. We just have the conviction, because it's worked for us so many times. Getting rid of the step increases the rate of adoption of Clerk. And we've seen it so many times that the marketing growth people absolutely told me this is going to make us blind to a lot of things. And they're right. Like, we are blind. We haven't figured out that question. But what we do know is that the top line acceleration of Clerk adoption has gone up. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters. There's things to figure out still. But yeah, overall, like, that one worked. That one drove a big inflection for us. So I will advise the audience, if you're building a DX thing, getting rid of steps always works. Or one kind of fallback for whatever reason, it always works.
If you're willing to do the work and make it happen, and then you see the inflection, it's like, well, we still have stuff work to do to figure this out, but we clearly made the right choice. Well, thank you again, Colin. It's great to finally chat. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
All right, you too. Thanks again so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.